listening to Angot for Arts, a podcast about reading
and writing
for people who love books.
This episode was recorded on Gadigal and Bidjigal lands of the Eora Nation.
Hello, book world, and welcome to the Angot for Arts podcast. My name is Sarah Sasson. I'm a Sydney-based author, doctor, and researcher, and I'll be your host. Every week, we'll be chatting to local authors and other members of the literary community. So let's see who we'll be catching up with this week. Melanie Cheng is an award-winning author and GP. She was born in Adelaide, grew up in Hong Kong, and now lives in Melbourne. Melanie's debut collection, Australia Day, won the Victorian Premier's Literary Award for an unpublished manuscript. This was followed by a novel, Room for a Stranger, and her latest work of fiction, also The Burrow, which was published in 2024 to critical acclaim, including being longlisted for the Miles Franklin Literary Award in 2025. Welcome, Melanie, to the Angot for Arts podcast. Thanks so much for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So it's the end of the year. How's your week going? Has it been filled with a lot of book-related things, or has it been a less bookish time?
I had a bit of a hiatus from book stuff, and then it's just kind of ramped up again this week. So yeah, my week started actually with a book club on Monday. And then on Tuesday, I had an interview with actually Australian Doctor about, I think, some of the similar themes that we're going to discuss today. So so it's been a bit more of a bookish week than it has been.
This year must have been massive for you with, we'll talk later about the release of The Burrow, but you must have been so busy with promotions and book festivals. And was it just starting to wind down, and then did things kick up again for you?
Yeah, as you probably know, Sarah, it does kind of wax and wane a little bit. And some of that is, you know, around your own leave and other non-bookish commitments. But I felt that with this book, The Burrow, I was better prepared for the publicity. I think with Australia Day, I was quite unprepared. And it kind of shocked me a little bit as to how to juggle the publicity stuff with the medical stuff, let alone trying to write something else. And my children were a lot younger at that time. So things are a lot easier now. The kids are much more independent.
A little bit more independent. Yeah. I mean, I think with your first book, you kind of have no idea what awaits you. But yeah, do you have to time the release of your books around your work schedule? Like, do you take time off when the book's coming out?
I think it's, as you know, more of a publisher decision about when the book is launched. There's so many thoughts that go into the timing of a book. So I was actually a bit surprised. My publication date was October 2024, which was quite close to Christmas, you know, and a lot of the big name books come out around that time. I remember, I think Tim Winton's book came out the exact same day as The Burrow, which I thought, I mean, there's one way of interpreting that, like I've made, but then also, you know, you're competing with these very big names. So, so not so much that the publisher, you know, makes concessions around me, but that I can, fortunately, in general practice, I can take time off quite easily, especially if I have a fair bit of notice. So I was better this time round at, you know, anticipating the busier times and making sure that I had taken time off at work for that. And I think this time I did a lot more kind of book visits, and I was a little bit more, I guess, willing to put in that early effort because I'd seen that it can pay off for other writing colleagues. But when you, with your first book, you really don't know. And also, I think publicists and your publisher are not always upfront, or perhaps they don't really know what works, what does help. It's I remember with Australia Day asking, well, what's the best thing that I can do? Will it help sales if I go to this festival? Will it help? And often you're met with a kind of Shrug.
Shrug, yeah.
And I think that's the truth of it.
What's the special sauce? Yeah, what's the secret recipe here?
We don't know what the special sauce is, and especially nowadays with influencers, it's become even less predictable what's going to work.
Yeah. So do you mean as you did more bookshop visits and... And did you actually go to the book club last night? Was it like a live event?
It was based in Sydney. So on Monday, I kind of zoomed in. But I have done face-to-face book clubs. But more when the book came out, I made a more of a conscious decision to go around
to the
bookstores and to get the publicist to kind of give them a heads up. And it can be an awkward experience sometimes.
I still remember going to my first bookshop and having no idea what I was supposed to do. I think it was the big Dimmicks in Sydney, and it was so strange to be on the other side of the equation.
Yeah. When you have your publicist with you, they kind of guide you, but that when you go on your own, which I did sometimes, you kind of sheepishly approach the desk and say, "Hi, I'm an author." And the booksellers are all very lovely. And of course, they do it all the time.
Exactly. No, I remember with my novel's debut novel, but part of my work is a public hospital roster. And we do our rosters like a year in advance. So there was this awkward time where they were trying to slate my book for release. And I was trying to get the date so that I could request those weeks off. But I'm publishing often, the date jumps around a bit. And I was like, I really didn't want the book to come out in a week. Whereas on call, but thankfully, but I couldn't explain how rigid the public health system was in terms of, and really they didn't care, they're not going to care about a book coming out. So you work as an author and as a GP. So what does that balance look like on a week-to-week basis?
Well, as we've discussed, it does vary a little bit, but an average week for me involves working part-time in general practice. So I have set things up so that I work 4 short sessions in general practice, and I have 1 day, which is kind of my writing day. I mean, the short days work because I could pick up my kids from school at the end of the day, and I would have, maybe 1.5 to 2 hours between wrapping up at work and picking up the kids to do mostly life admin, let's say grocery shopping, but every so often a bit of editing or maybe a little bit of work on a manuscript. But then I have that 1 day a week, which is reserved for the kind of bigger chunk of writing. So it takes me a long time to write a book, and I tend to write short books. I've somehow made it kind of work in that way. But
which day is your writing day?
It's Thursday.
Thursday.
That's more due to the clinic requirements and rooms and things like that. But Thursday, actually, a lot of book events tend to happen on Thursday.
Okay.
So it hasn't worked out too badly. I did like having Mondays off previously.
Yeah. So I kind of daydream at the moment about having a day like that. And then I wonder how disciplined I'd be and how often, how productive are you on that day? And do sometimes you kind of trade off that day to do other things, or do you have to be quite strict?
Certainly there's trade-offs. I mean, I think that's the great irony as well of writing, is that when you're not writing, all you want to do is write, but then you are actually gifted the time, you seem to find many excuses not to do it. And I suspect that's because it's not easy. And so we tend to procrastinate. But I used to fantasize about having a writing retreat, because so many of my friends do that. But I think the reality for me is that I wouldn't know what to do with school swathe of time. I'd probably waste it.
And there is something about writing, what do I say, with a foot in the world, or, something about carrying the story of, especially a contemporary novel around with you. And I kind of like holding it up what's going on in my life or what's going on the news at the time, because sometimes you pick up on little connections there, or, you know, if you take your story with you throughout a busy day.
Yeah, I think so. I guess different things work for different people. I know many writers who swear by a retreat, and I can see that that would be appealing, especially for maybe even like the structural edit, you know, when you're doing that really hard big picture stuff. I think sometimes I've always worked in short bursts, but sometimes the big picture stuff is when you do really need to immerse yourself and hide away for a period.
On the timeline. And so how does the intimate work of caring for people as a GP, especially across their lifespan, do you find that informs your writing?
Oh, I think the work most definitely informs the writing. I mean, I don't live a very exciting life. So, and part for me, part of the magic of writing is being able to escape myself and escape my own lived experience. And in general practice, I get to have those insights into other people's lives and worlds. And I like that you mention the kind of caring for people across the lifespan. I think, again, that does inform the work, particularly with the burrow. You know, there's that intergenerational relationship between the grandmother Pauline and Lucy. And of course, that's informed by my own family, but I think when it's only your own family, you always wonder, well, is this unique to us or is there some universality? And when you do care for people, you know, at the extremes of ages, you start to see the common themes, the recurring themes. And so, I mean, that's great for me just as an individual human being and understanding the human condition and feeling solidarity with other people, but it's also great as a novelist because you have some sense that what you write will then resonate.
Yeah, it's interesting. My partner works in intensive care, and so he meets, you know, patients and their family, you know, at these really acute times, you know, often in the worst weeks of their life, and then has very little, you know, doesn't have lots of ongoing care. And then I work as a physician, so we often have these funny conversations because, you know, sometimes I'll have patients for years, but then our family GP growing up, you know, we had this really amazing GP and he looked after like three generations of my family. Like he saw us as kids and then my parents, and then he also took care of my dad's mum as well. And I often, when I was reading you and reading The Burrow, I thought about that because you'd also pick up on these, if you're seeing different people from the same family separately. That's so if you're interested in human relationships, I'm sure you see some interesting dynamics going on between families, and, you know, one member will say something and then you'll hear a different, slightly different point of view from someone else. So it just, yeah, really, and that's interesting in The Burrow because so much of it is sort of unpicking the relationships of the family.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that is something that we see in general practice, and it lends itself to that multi-perspective novel, which is obviously what I did with The Burrow. I think part of that was also, you know, informed by my, what I call my apprenticeship in short stories, in that I, you know, I grew accustomed to jumping in and out of various characters' heads. And so I don't love being constrained to one perspective, I've realized. Until now, I haven't written a book from a single protagonist's perspective, perhaps from that reason. But yeah, I think it's also interesting to see the different reactions to a singular event. And in The Burrow, that's a sudden accidental loss, because that is something that I see in the work, particularly around grief. There obviously is commonality in that experience, but the way people behave after a loss can differ quite wildly, as it does in the family, the Lee family that's featured in the book.
Yeah, that's interesting to think about. So your first book, Australia Day, came out in 2017, and that was a collection of short stories exploring multiculturalism and national identity, and it won the Victorian Premier's Award for Fiction. That was followed by two novels, Room for a Stranger in 2019 and most recently The Burrow in 2024, both listed for the Miles Franklin Award. Congratulations. Have you always been an avid reader and writer? And what was your pathway to becoming traditionally published?
I've always been an avid reader and writer, most definitely. The reading came first. I love that Saul Bellow quote that a writer is a reader moved to emulation. That speaks to me. So I just adored reading. It was my escape from reality as a kid. And then at high school, I think it was probably where I fell in love with writing. It was through a great English teacher, Mr. Alexander, whom we affectionately referred to as Mr. A, who really inspired, my writing and seemed to, get my style of writing as well, which I think is always great when you're an aspiring writer. And so I relished any opportunity for creative writing, had a few pieces published, as a teenager in the student magazine and things. But then I obviously went down the more vocational scientific route on graduating from high school, and I studied medicine at Melbourne Uni. And as you know, Sarah, there's not a lot of spare time when you're studying medicine, especially I did the more traditional Oxford-based degree. We were the last year to do that very kind of dry scientific.
Is that 3 years of the sciences and then 3 years in the hospital?
Right, yeah. So I see the med students now because we do a narrative medicine course with them, and I think, oh, you guys get to do breadth subjects and you do narrative medicine electives. That was never what our experience. I remember having to memorize what flint tools were found with Australopithecus africanus. Like, it's just completely irrelevant information that I'm
doing. So I use that all the time. Day-to-day basis.
So I'm glad the course has evolved. But yeah, there wasn't much spare time. So I wasn't even reading much, fiction, let alone writing it for all those years of training. Mm-hmm. But as I reassure the med students that I see now, the study does eventually end. It's a long time, but it does. And then suddenly you have some spare time and you have ownership over that time. And that was really when I started to think about writing again. And I've mentioned before about this creative doctors network that used to hold these sessions where doctors from all different disciplines could come and showcase their creative pursuit. So it was, just very amateur, but it was very wide-ranging. You could see that some doctors were doing short films, some photography, some music, and of course writing. And I think what I really took away from that day was just how happy and relaxed many of the doctors seemed. And it was really in contrast to a lot of the consultants that I trained under at the tertiary public hospitals.
So which point did you have that time to come back? Was it after you had finished your GP training, or was it while
after GP training?
That's when you kind of had the time to come back to it. And what about leaving high school? Was that a difficult decision for you to pursue medicine over writing? Was that like a conflict, or was it kind of, you just thought it was sort of?
No, I was torn. I mean, I liked both the sciences and the humanities and the arts. So it was a difficult decision. I think I was helped along perhaps by my
a little bit of
Chinese father who did, suggest that perhaps life as a writer wouldn't be as stable or secure as if I went down a more vocational path. And, he is right. The average income of a writer in Australia is like $18,000 annually. So it's true, unfortunately. But, now that I look back, I wouldn't have it any other way, because as I've mentioned already, the work informs so much of the writing, and I'm not sure what I would write about if I hadn't had the experiences of caring for patients, as you mentioned, across the lifestyle.
And there is this long history of physician writers like, Keats and Atul Gawande. There is this tradition of doctors writing. And I think part of that is because, in high school we're allowed to do more than one thing, and we're allowed to be good at science and writing, and that's okay. But also, as you've alluded to, treating patients, being with families in times of grief and joy, it's all about the human condition. And I think often, that needs to come out somewhere. Like you said, practicing medicine It's demanding physically, emotionally, and I think in that creative doctors network, a lot of it has to come out in some form. Like I think that's healthy to express what you're living through as well as the physician. Yeah, and I see a lot of doctors, like you mentioned, who, you know, medicine can consume most of your life, but hidden underneath there, you know, a lot of doctors do play instruments, or, you know, they often do have these skills and talents or even just passions. And yeah, I mean, we'll talk about it later, but I think it's very healthy not to discourage that, because I think if everything gets bottled up and your life becomes really only within the walls of the clinic or the hospital, I don't think that leads to a happy place.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's what has been so rewarding and gratifying about doing the narrative medicine course is that, you know, in that context, the students are writing not for publication. So there's not that goal or outcome. It's really just purely for the joy of writing and also, you know, perhaps processing something and finding meaning in the work as well. So, yeah.
It's in year 12, I was similar to you. So I loved English and I loved biology. And, you know, some of my teachers were like, oh, you really like writing. You should think about a career in writing. But it was all about journalism and, you know, the kind of I really liked writing poetry. So I was thinking, oh, writing poetry. And they were thinking writing journalism. And I couldn't think of anything more stressful than having to write to such a tight deadline. So that's when I kind of jumped and said, oh, maybe I'll just do science.
Poetry and journalism.
I know. It's
completely different.
Totally different. Like, yeah. Can take years to write a good poem.
Yeah, I guess it's like within medicine, right? Being a GP versus being a neurosurgeon or a pathologist, they're wildly different experiences.
Exactly. So let's talk about The Burrow, your most recent novel, which I've got here. The Burrow centres on the Lee family in Melbourne. It's Amy and Jin and their 10-year-old daughter, Lucy. Family dynamics are strained, and when Amy's mother Pauline comes to stay, we learn that the Lees are living in the aftermath of a significant, unexpected trauma. So what made you want to write about the powerful microcosm of a family?
Well, the first two books, Australia Day and Room for a Stranger, were not really about families at all. They were often actually about chance encounters, because I think for a long time I was quite interested in these, connections between strangers and what impact that can have on a life. So I felt like perhaps I got that out of my system in those two books. And when it came to writing a third, I was interested in making a departure from that and looking at a more intimate type of relationship. And so the family relationship is perhaps the most intimate of the relationships. And I think the other thing that's interesting to me about a family or the domestic home as a setting is that we show aspects of ourselves that we perhaps don't show to anyone else. You know, we're often performing, even with our friends, and certainly in our workplace. And so you see things in the family home that nobody else gets to see. So I was interested in exploring that. But I'm not sure that I would have been able to write a family story for my first novel. And as a writer, and then having to, you know, speak to that publicly, I think I would have found that very, you know, exposing, and I would have felt very vulnerable, I think. Whereas by the time I had my third book, both me and my family were kind of
ready for it,
used to the public face of promotion. And so I think, yeah, we had some strategies and coping mechanisms for that.
That's interesting to hear, and that the first two books, yeah, how they prepared you maybe for the third. But yeah, I'd never felt anything so strange as, you know, this really solo pursuit as writing a novel. Like, it's so intimate, but you spend a lot of that time by yourself, and then all of a sudden you're put on a public stage to discuss some of the thoughts that drives the writing. Yeah, as a new writer, like you say, it's very you feel very exposed, and then you get asked questions that sometimes come out of left field and you're not prepared for them.
Well, and also as a female writer particularly, but any writer to some degree, people assume that everything you write is
Oh,
autobiographical.
absolutely,
And
absolutely.
so I think if you're writing about a family story, like in The Burrow, I've had fun with it. I've played with it. There's a lot of autobiographical details in the book, in terms of the background of the family and things like that, having a Chinese father and a, Australian mother, which is similar to my personal family, and then having the mother be a writer and the father be a doctor. So I was happy to play with it. Wasn't scared of people asking me about, how much of this is taken from your life. Whereas I think with the first book, I would have struggled with that. Yeah, I would have struggled with that prying and probing and people trying to work out, oh, is this you? And is this really what you think? But people are going to do that to some degree. So the other day, for instance, when I went to pick up my son from school, a mum who I'm good friends with kind of didn't come up to say hello at the gates because she'd read my book a few months prior. And she was like, oh, Amy in the book, she doesn't love the school pickup, chatter. So I didn't know. I thought maybe you don't like it.
Oh, that's so funny.
But that's the kind of thing that you have to
Oh,
face
totally.
people
So
read
yeah.
the work. So I was very keen, no, that's not me. Maybe I have days where I feel that way, but please do come chat
That's hilarious.
to
Yeah, that's exactly what happened to me. That's the first question anyone, because my story is about a young girl with an older brother who kind of goes missing, and the first question everyone wanted to know from my first editor, the publisher, yeah, and most readers, they just immediately want to know, if it's true, if it's my story, which it's not. But yeah, it was unsettling for me because I clearly, put it forward as fiction. But I think with your debut book as well, no one knows you, from a bar of soap, and so that's sort of like your introduction to the world. But that's it's good to hear that you develop this confidence on how to handle it. And
I think so. I think once you accept, and I've heard Michelle de Cretza talk about this with her latest novel, where she's, really playing with it. Once you accept that they're going to do it anyway,
anyway.
and you can kind of, well, let's have fun with
Yeah,
it and relax
exactly.
into it a little bit.
So in the book, there's also a rabbit named Fiver, who I think was inspired a little bit by Watership Down, and the rabbit's adopted into the family at the book's opening. So I'm interested, at what point of creating the novel did you have the idea for the rabbit? And what does Fiver illuminate about the Lee family?
So the inspiration for including a rabbit actually came from my own rabbit. So our family did take in a mini lop rabbit towards the end of 2020. So
Lockdown
well into the pandemic. And for us, it was not a second choice pet. It was a first choice pet because my daughter, like a little like Lucy, was quite obsessed with rabbits. She's born in the Chinese year of the rabbit, and she always had soft toy rabbits as comforters and things. So I think I probably thought, oh, it might be a little easier than a dog or a cat to care for. So we can go with this. But what ended up happening was that I became quite fascinated with this creature, and mainly because it was this prey animal. And so it behaved in a very different way to the more traditional pets of cats and dogs. We don't think of as predators, but they are. And so they are able to relax in this way that prey animals cannot. And of course, I knew this on an intellectual level, but then when you actually take in this creature and see how kind of watchful and easily startled they are, and how they don't sleep for very long, they sort of sleep with their eyes open, especially a new, juvenile rabbit. I've found it interesting, and I think it was because it was during the pandemic at a time where I was also myself quite watchful and hypervigilant and not sleeping very much, to see this kind of mirroring. I just found it very interesting, and for the first time in a long time, I found myself wanting to write about this.
Do they seem anxious? Is it does the rabbit seem anxious? Wait, is it
When we
just from their
first got him,
description?
definitely. He's a bit more chill now. You can tell that they're very watchful. Prey animals have to be. They have to
Because
be.
they're defenseless, essentially defenseless. All they can do is run and
They
burrow,
can
right?
run and
Or
hide,
hop. Yeah, that's it.
basically. And I mean, it was so, great in terms of themes and symbolism because we were all hiding too in the
In the
pandemic.
house.
And then this family who's grieving are also trying to run and hide. And so yeah, I thought thematically it could work. I did have doubts about it because you mentioned Watership Down, and I guess I always thought rabbits are really the domain of children's literature. Who's going to want to read a adult fiction book with a rabbit in it? But around the same time, I was reading Charlotte Wood's book on craft, The Luminous Solution. And, in that book, she explores how writers get their ideas. So she did a PhD on it, and she talks about this kind of heat. And a heat-seeking impulse that writers have. So we feel drawn to certain subject matters without really being able to rationalize it or intellectualize it. And she suggests that we should surrender to that. And actually, it's the books in which writers do that that are often the most powerful books. And so reading that kind of, I felt like I had permission then. Well, if it's good enough for Charlotte, good enough for me,
I
and I
love the
will.
luminous solution. I love that she's got a brilliant quote in there about like wormholes of fascination, how writers sort of like, you have they just sit there, and we can't explain what it is, but something will capture your imagination, like you've just said. And you kind of have to mine that. You could probably not on a conscious level, what you're following, but there'll be something at the end of it. It was interesting for me because when I it's funny with that, how we both wanted to be writers when we were young and then went and did medicine. But when I decided it was like the moment I sat my last exam in immunology and I'd finally popped out the other side and all of a sudden didn't have to study for exams anymore. And just this hunger to write just popped back. And it's funny when you have that, like I just felt like my writing self had been patiently waiting for all those years and then it just popped back. But one of the first stories I wrote, you had to write something that had, oh, exercise, it was like you had to write something that happened in your life and then you had to reimagine it as a fable. And I wrote from the point of view of a rabbit. So I was really interested in reading the burrow. And yeah, when I was writing, firstly, just all the language that sort of comes up when you write from the point of view of a rabbit. But the same, I was thinking, oh, rabbits, like all the symbolism is like the lucky rabbit's foot or rabbit's stew or the skin. Like you're saying, the prey animals, like they've just sort of used and abused and chased. So like, yeah, they are quite vulnerable. But I love that connection you made between the pet rabbit and how humans behave during the pandemic. So the burrow takes place sort of at the tail end of the COVID-19 pandemic and lockdown. So it sounds like that was always part of the genesis of your novel. When you went through editing, was there any suggestions to change the inclusion of lockdown? And what effect did the Melbourne lockdowns have on your creative practice? Because I know out of most of the country, I think Melbourne, you suffered through lockdowns the most.
So yeah, I mean, I said the end of 2020, and that's kind of when the book set, but that might have been the tail end of lockdowns for most of the parts of
Just the middle
the
bit for you.
country. That was just like a quarter in for us. We had a lot more in store. We didn't know it at the time, of course. But yeah, so it was probably one of the times where I wrote the least. I only started work really on the burrow in, I think, 2022, probably, like proper, serious work. I mean, it was brewing there, as ideas do brew. But I think I was quite depleted creatively during most of that time. I mean, working as a GP in that time was difficult. You had to keep on top of the news all the time. Things were constantly changing, not just the restrictions, but then the vaccines. And, it felt like any time there was any confusion, the government would come out and say, "Go see your GP,
And the
speak
GP's like,
to your GP about your questions about the vaccines." And here we are behind the scenes scrambling to try and, because everything was moving very fast. So there was that. And then my kids were quite young, and my son started, prep in the pandemic years. So we were homeschooling at home as well. So that was really, so there was not much time. But I also, yeah, I didn't feel inspired to write during that time. And in fact, when I finally, sat down to write the manuscript for the burrow, I didn't really want to write about the pandemic either, because as I said, I was started maybe, like late 2021, early 2022, and we were still kind of in a lot of it. I didn't really want to go there. But as you know, when you, because I'm not a plotter either, I kind of come to a work with a premise and some characters. And then for me, part of the magic is not knowing what's going to happen when I sit down at the desk and just kind of trying to stay true to the characters. So yeah, I just, as I started writing, it just seemed right to set it during that time. It explains why the family takes in the pet, which is the same reason that my own family did. And it kind of explains why Pauline has to come and stay with them and be cared for them. And so it made a lot of sense from a purely like a plot point of view. But of course, thematically, it made a lot of sense as well because, the pandemic for suddenly, showed us all how uncertain and unstable our lives are. Most of us until then, or many of us, if we're privileged and lucky, could go about our lives making plans for, 2 years' time,
Holidays.
thinking that they're actually going to eventuate. And, assuming that next week will be much like, this week was. And the pandemic really shattered that and shattered that illusion for us. So there was that, but also the kind of isolation and hiding, all of that really spoke to the bigger themes. And, on some level, I think we need to process this collectively. I individually probably needed to process a little bit of it. The publisher, I guess, wasn't thrilled about it. Just in terms of on paper, they knew that readers would be wary of it, and they're right. I still like on Goodreads reviews, I've seen reviews that said I wasn't sure about this book because it was set in the pandemic. And one of my favorite reviews is still, this is the first pandemic novel I read that I didn't hate.
Oh, high praise, high praise. Well, I remember reading something about, like, in the arts pages about, oh, who's going to write the big COVID-19 pandemic novel? And then this slow realization that, like, the whole world just lived through this, and, like, no one wants to sit down and read anything, at least kind of like a blow by blow kind of, realistic portrayal of what it was like, because we all kind of knew what it was like. But I think part of the Burroughs' success is it's kind of, the pandemic's there in the sort of background or informing it, but it's not sort of front and center. Because I think a lot of people, yeah, still kind of traumatized and don't want to relive it. But I did notice a few books that came out, because I think even Sally Rooney had a book coming out, Beautiful World, Where Are You? And she kind of drops in the lockdowns at the end of that. But then I'm thinking in 50 years' time, people are going to look back and say, well, where's all the literature? Is there going to be a gap? It's just funny to think there's a 1-in-100-year event, and not many people are really, it hasn't really been written down significantly yet, but maybe it will in the years to come.
Yeah, I guess as writers, often you do need that distance, don't you, to be able to write about something. I think I did read some really great novels with the pandemic, not necessarily at the forefront, but there, and like Lucy by the Sea by
Yeah, I love that book as well. Yeah.
Stroud dealt with it, I think, quite beautifully. And Angela O'Keefe, the Australian writer's book, The Sitter, also. So I think, I can't remember the order. Maybe I was reading them while I was writing. But yeah, there were a few examples where I thought, oh yes, people are doing this in a subtle, sensitive way that feels right. And yeah,
And
so
then maybe in 10 years someone will write a book and nostalgically set it during the pandemic.
well, that's the thing about the lockdowns, that for some writers, actually, they found it a very productive time. But I guess it depended on if you were
On your
homeschooling, I think
circumstances,
it was really not productive.
If you're working as a GP with two kids, it's probably not having lots of time. One of my favorite passages in the Burrow is when Jin's blindsided by a moment of his phone when it throws up on this day 5 years ago. And you write, "And nowadays, memories were everywhere. Everybody carried little shiny memory grenades in their pockets." So, what's your relationship like with the modern onslaught of technology and media? And do you find these elements challenge the traditional storylines or the way we used to write storylines?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I have very mixed, kind of ambivalent feelings towards, social media and AI. I mean, I think I fluctuate wildly day to day. I have some real concerns about the people that are in power and controlling the technology. And I think, just very recently, we've had, a lot of revelations in, big publications like Time and the New York Times about, Meta and that they knowingly were allowing, adult child, contact and trafficking. And, with AI, there's this class action lawsuit about, wrongful deaths as a result of people using a sycophantic AI for their mental health counseling. So there are some real dangers. And so, and as a parent of, preteens and teens, it's terrifying. I have real concerns about the people that are pulling the strings and about their ethics. In terms of technology itself, I mean, if I do write contemporary, so I feel like you have to include it or you're really not being true to the time. And I feel like I know how to do that now. You don't make a big deal about it. You don't signpost it. You just, include it as we do in our lives, as, just this is this incidental thing that we're using, like the telephone or anything else. And I think if you do it in that way, readers will respond well to it. Some writers I've heard, worry about, because it will be out of date by the time, your book is published, it's going to seem. But I mean, I think we read books from the past all the time and we accept that kind of, context and that it can't be up to date. I don't see that as necessarily being an issue. Yeah, with that scene with Jin, I think that was something that I wanted to express because it was my experience that sometimes you can be in the moment and then the phone really interjects itself and interferes and kind of derails you. And that's the problem with the technology sometimes, I think, is that, yeah, suddenly, for instance, Jin is it's kind of guiding Jin to think about something that he wouldn't have otherwise thought of. And I think.
Because I noticed when I started writing, I think because a lot of the books I'd read growing up were sort of pre the sort of technological sort of revolution. And so I was in my brain, my education had been, like those books. And then as it was that when you're writing modern contemporary Australian literature, you realize you have to engage with the technology. But I think I hadn't read at the time a lot of how to integrate the phone messages and the social media. But now I think there's a lot of contemporary literature that does it really well. So there's more of a guide. But yeah, I think I remember thinking at the time, like, how are we going to do this? Because realistically, they're going to have phones, they're going to be sending emojis to each other. So yeah, I'm like, you sort of have to try, but you don't want it to sort of dominate the text, especially if you're writing literary fiction. Like there's sort of an interesting tension there because literary fiction, you're thinking more of like ideas and subtleties and abstracts, and then all of a sudden they're like sending emojis on
Yeah.
their phone.
I've seen a critique of actually Rooney, someone talking about how she used social media. And because I think what this book in particular was written, when it was quite new. And so she did do a bit of signposting and it did seem, I mean, far be it for me to criticize Rooney, but that it could seem a bit clunky or clumsy at the time, because you're kind of explaining the technology and then, and contextualizing it. But I also heard an interview with Richard Osman recently talking about crime. So I think for crime writers, it's really tricky for people to have phones because it does mean that you basically got access to all information at any time in your hand. So it does affect how crime writers can reveal things. So he was talking about, yeah, it's great to get people on like an island before they've seen
There's no Wi-Fi.
something or setting it in the past. And I've heard, Alice Pong talk about her YA book, Lorinda, which she set, in the past when she was a teenager, because again,
Just to take that complexity
out
of it. It
would be so difficult to get the language. I mean, my 14-year-old just rolls her eyes anytime I try to mimic the lingo. So I wouldn't dare try to kind of keep up to date with that or convey that in a book. So yeah many
it's interesting about the crime. I mean, I'm not much of a crime writer, but my understanding is like the police, you know, that's are using phones a lot to help solve crime, and also just like how we're all being surveilled by like lots of digital cameras everywhere. Like it probably changes a lot of real crime and fictional crime. So we've talked a bit about the Creative Doctors Network event that you went to in Sydney as a kind of turning point in your life or in your writing. How did that event impact you, and what benefits are there in leading a creative life, even if your day job is not in the arts?
Well, I mean, there's so many benefits. So we've touched on a lot of them already. But yeah, for me personally, they're quite complementary. You know, I think perhaps in the past, I quite glamorized the lifestyle of a writer, perhaps. And I thought, oh, it would just be wonderful. And it's all. But, you know, now that I am a published author, there are lots of things that are frustrating about a writing life and the publishing industry, you know, especially now with the threat of AI and the declining reading rate. So to have these dual careers, I think is not a bad thing. You know, when I get frustrated with writing, I can
put your stethoscope on. Yeah.
Just go see some patients. And when, you know, there's many things that are frustrating about general practice, not usually the core work. It's usually to do with, you know, access or waiting times at hospitals or all the admin. So, you know, there's this kind of thing that when you're a bit like, I guess, that Chekhov quote, with when you're bored with one, you can switch and then switch to the other. I mean, he used the analogy of a wife and mistress, but I perhaps wouldn't use that analogy. But yeah, there's some truth to that. And as I mentioned with the narrative medical students, you know, there is something lovely about being able to turn to writing when you're feeling agitated or frustrated and maybe kind of not perhaps doing it as a therapeutic thing, but just trying to make sense of something and writing your way towards a truth, which I think at its essence is what we're often trying to do when we write. So yeah, it's a tool.
Do you find you have a lot of medical students and junior doctors approaching you saying they want to write or they're interested in trying to balance a career in writing and medicine?
Yeah, there are a few. I think it's become almost a bit of a trope, hasn't it? The writer doctor. There's quite a few of us around. And I think in most writing groups, there's at least one doctor writer there.
We're going to saturate the industry.
So, yeah, I think it speaks to, you know, the things that we're encountering that we make for a good story, but also inspire us to maybe want to write that story down. I mean, the reality is also that, you know, if you do have a career where, you know, you have a stable income, then it does allow you the luxury of then maybe doing some writing on the side and not relying on that as your source of income too. And that's a privilege. But yeah, I try to be honest with those students that come to me and, you know, explain that it requires hard work, as much hard work as medicine. It's not easy. And I think I've seen now, because I do mentorships through Kill Your Darlings and other programs, and I see now that, you know, you need some talent, but you need really a lot of persistence to be able to be successful in this work. And sometimes I can see it even in the people that I mentor. They may be super talented, but you can tell they're not hungry enough for it. They're not like eager for your feedback, you know. They may be a bit defensive, I can see the ones that, you know, they just want to soak in anything and make the work as good as it can possibly be. And they get disappointed when they get a rejection, but then they get themselves together, and then they're just even more determined to make the work better. And ultimately, those are the people who are going to
Who will go on?
make it, I think. That's what I've realized.
So we're coming to the end of our hour. So I just will finish with asking, what book are you reading now? And is there another book that you read recently that you would recommend to listeners?
So, as you know, Sarah, when you publish books, people come and ask you for endorsements
Ah,
of
yes.
books. And so you get this great experience of being able to read books before anyone else.
Oh, so you can't tell us, is that what you're
No, I
saying?
can tell
Oh,
you.
you can?
So
Okay.
I'm currently reading Good Boy by Michelle Wright. I haven't written her endorsement yet, so she might be hearing this for the first time. But yeah, it's a wonderful book about a man in prison who is part of this, dog rehabilitation program. And Good Boy is the name of the dog, but it was also playing, of course, on this good behavior, bad behavior, and the criminal justice system. And Michelle Wright is a dear friend of mine, and she is a wonderful short story writer. I used to kind of hate her because she would win all the competitions that I went to. And that was before I knew her. And then I got to know her, and then I discovered
Now
she's
you're winning some
lovely.
competitions, so you can be friends with her.
So that's one book that people have coming up in store. Another one I read recently, I mentioned Angela O'Keefe already recently, with her book The Sitter, which I loved. And she's got another, again, a slim novel, very, very slim. I love a novella, and her new book is called Phantom Days. So if people liked The Sitter, I'm sure they will love Phantom Days. So those are
Amazing.
really great books coming your way.
Thank you. I will put them in the show notes. Well, thanks so much for your time today. I really enjoyed chatting to you and sharing some of your stories and wisdom, and we look forward to what's to come for you and for your next books as well.
No, thank you.
Thank
It's
you.
been an absolute pleasure. Thank you
So much.